offering my loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series. This is Prem coming to you live from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam. We are here to resume our discussion on the Bhagavad Gita. We are about to complete the 9th chapter, and with that, we would be completing exactly one half of the Bhagavad Gita, looking at it from the point of view of the number of chapters. Of course, like we do always, we will definitely have a summary of this chapter next week, but we'll complete the chapter today. We only have 2 verses to go. We'll start with a summary of what we covered last time, the 3 verses that we covered, verses 30, 31, and 32. Krishna continues the theme of the glory of bhakti. What makes devotion so special? As we've seen, in many ways, bhakti has also been redefined. And having defined bhakti in that particular way, Krishna is talking about the glory of bhakti. Because if you do not look at the definition, and if you look at only the glory of bhakti, you will, or we all will, do the mistake of glorifying our idea of what is bhakti. So it is important to keep in mind what is that definition that Krishna has given for bhakti. To put it very briefly, there will be faith that leads to contentment and acceptance. That's a sign of bhakti. Acceptance of the present, that will lead us to performing each one of our duties with sincerity, and that duty itself will be done as worship. An acceptance of the future will lead one to accept all results of the actions that we perform as prasadam. So there will be equanimity in the mind. And most importantly, one will be able to, or at least will strive to see God in every person and individual they come across with, including themselves. More or less, this is what Krishna has defined as bhakti. This is essentially devotion, not just the act of doing some puja or performing some rituals. And Krishna says, if such devotion starts taking root in one's heart, such a person should be considered noble. To make it more clear, Krishna says, take the person whom, according to you, is the worst, Sudurachara, a perfectly bad person. Even a Sudurachara, Bhajate Mam Ananya Bhak, if he worships me with such Ananya Bhakti, with such one-pointedness, Sadureva Samantavya, he should be considered to be a sadhu, a noble one. Why is that? Krishna explains that the resolution in the mind is clear when one becomes a devotee. The understanding that is required to correct one's ways has been established in the mind. And you are what you are because of your thoughts, not because necessarily always because of what you do. Right? He continues that in the 31st verse. He says, Kshipram Bhavati Dharmatma. Very soon, the person becomes righteous. And Shashvat Shanti Nigachati. And he attains supreme peace. Kshipram bhavati dharmatma. Whatever may be the state of that person, you might consider him as Sudurachara, a person who is bad, who is given to wrong means. But once this devotion of one-pointedness takes root, kshipram bhavati dharmatma. It's a matter of time. It's in a very short period of time, he becomes a dharmatma and shashvat shantim nigachati. He attains supreme peace. So 2 things are conveyed here. Any past can be corrected through such devotion, and there is no exclusivity. Even the worst of persons can take to devotion and transform completely. Swami would often give the example of the highway robber Ratnakara, who becomes sage Valmiki. Somebody who steals, somebody who kills. Such a person, through devotion, through the blessing of a guru who takes to the path of Namasmarana and devotion, becomes the great sage Valmiki. Krishna further emphasizes this point in the next shloka. But before that, he makes a very firm declaration in the 31st verse itself. He says, Kaunteya, O Arjuna, Pratijanihi, proclaim with confidence or have this confidence, Me Bhaktaha na pranashyati, my devotees do not perish. A very beautiful and firm declaration from the Lord. In the 33rd verse, Krishna says, in the 32nd verse, Krishna says, by taking refuge in me, even a person who has a sinful birth, a punya yoni, a woman, a vaishya or a shudra can attain the ultimate. We discuss what does Krishna mean by this. It is not that women or people born in these classes are lower in any way. The social structure may deny them some opportunities, which we think are critical for spiritual progress, like having a guru who initiates them, or the chance to learn and chant the Vedas or entry into the temples. In this shloka, Krishna dismisses all those mental obstacles that we might have. Till this point, Krishna has been emphasizing about the greatness of bhakti. But let us not forget, a good birth is also not an ordinary thing. That is also a blessing, right? Till this point, he said, you may be born in this category, you may be born as this, as that, but still with devotion you can attain it. But earlier, Krishna had said, a person who is unable to complete a spiritual journey, a yoga bhrashta, is given a better shot by him being or her being granted a birth in a noble family, in such a family where one can take forward that journey, right? So being born in a cultured family or a well-endowed family is also a blessing in a certain way. And that is what is going to be discussed in the next shloka. So as I said, we are going to go through the final two shlokas of the 9th chapter. Both of these shlokas are also important in certain ways for us because of some things that Swami remarks about these two shlokas. We will come to that. So this beautiful chapter comes to close with two very profound and very beautiful shlokas. As always, we'll listen to the shloka, the 33rd shloka in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a very brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss in detail what Krishna conveys in this.
Kim punar brahmanah punyah bhakta rajarshayastatha anityamasukham lokam imam prapya bhajasvamam.
So that is the 33rd verse of the 9th chapter. I've not got the simple meaning of that one. I will explain the shloka as we go through. But the essence of what Krishna is conveying there is, what is there to be said then about those who are born as Brahmins, who are born in noble families, those who are devotees, those who are Rajarishis? This world is impermanent and is full of sorrow. Having attained a life in this earth, worship me. That's the essential meaning of that particular verse, the 33rd verse. This also is the penultimate verse of this chapter. Again, as I said, it contains something that is spoken of quite often by Swami. It contains a line we've heard many, many times from Swami. Anityam asukham lokam imam prapya bhajasvamam. But we will come to that eventually. As I was saying, here it is a continuation of what Krishna was saying in the previous two shlokas about how bhakti can transform any kind of life. He said, even if someone is given to bad ways or if born into a disadvantageous position, when she or he develops ananya bhakti, kshipram, very soon they become a dharmatma. In this shloka, Krishna carries forward that by asking, Kim punaha? How much more? Meaning, how much more can be said? Brahmanaha, of Brahmins. Punyaha, the holy ones. Bhaktaha, the devoted. Rajarishaha tatha, and the royal saints. Even if you're born in a sinful environment or into a gender or a family or a caste that takes away some opportunities of sadhana from you, if you develop one-pointed devotion, you can attain the supreme state. Then imagine if you're born into a situation of advantage. Brahmanaha, he says. And I feel this need not be seen as Brahmins, one particular caste or sect of in the society. When Krishna says Brahmanaha Punyaha, he refers to, I think, those of us who are born into families where we are introduced to devotion like all other habits, just like how certain table manners is taught to us, certain ways of carrying ourselves in front of others is taught to us. Even devotion is taught to us like a good habit. When we are children, we are taught how to pray. When we were children, our mother taught us, pray before you sleep, you will not have nightmares. A simple thing, and the child doesn't question when taught such things. So as a child, we followed it, and when we follow it, we find that it is true. Praying before we go to sleep does seem to help in some way. So that's an advantage, isn't it? It is given to us at an age where we don't really question, and then we absorb it. I didn't have to discover it myself. It was given to me as a lesson from the family. So too, some families bring up their children, teaching them to do charity. If there is a festival or a birthday, they inculcate this habit of probably going out and feeding the poor instead of throwing a lavish and ostentatious party. As a child, you never know. A child always enjoys to have a party with friends around. But when the parents teach that this is a better thing to do, at that age, there is a higher chance that you may take to it. Isn't it? Then Krishna says, Bhaktaha Rajarashaha Tatha, the devout and the royal sages. So too is the case with devotion, isn't it? Many children are born into families of devotees. They inherit love and devotion for Swami from their parents. I was reading a book some time back of a devotee who came to Swami in the early 1940s. And they go on to say how 5 generations of their family have become devotees of Swami. They're spread all across the globe, different age groups, different professions, but all of them are devoted to Swami. Each individual indeed will have their own journey. Nevertheless, it gives a good head start if being born in a family where you can inherit devotion, isn't it? And this certainly does not take away the importance of effort in the present. If you really look at it, Arjuna is born with all these advantages we just spoke about. On top of that, he also has the comradeship of the avatar himself. Still, Krishna is telling him to act and live life in a certain way to reach the goal. So this is not to say being born with such advantages is alone enough. He specifically then mentions Raja Rishis. If I can interpret it that way, those who are born in affluence but still have their mind focused on spirituality and God. That again is a blessing, because to be born in an affluent family means your mind does not have to be given to small things of, you know, how do I make my ends meet? What do I do for this? What do I do for that? Your mind is freed from all of these preoccupations. And then if you are also given this insight of what one has to do with the mind, how to develop devotion, how to develop a spiritual life, that becomes an advantage. So Raja Rishaya probably is an indication of that advantage. So what we are to take from this is a sense of reassurance, a sense of confidence. That is the whole idea that I feel Krishna is conveying in this portion. If we were to honestly look at our own lives, the advantages that we have are enormous. you are sitting and listening to me boring you on this fine Thursday morning, isn't it because your mind has turned to Swami and his message? Somewhere the desire for trying to understand the secrets of life has sprung in your mind. That cannot be denied, and that's a huge advantage for each one of us, isn't it? Krishna is saying, look at all the advantages you have. And now imagine if you are able to foster that ananya bhakti, which Krishna says, if you have, you cannot get ruined. Your needs and your fears will be taken care of. I will assure your yoga kshema, Krishna had said. There is no way we can fail in this path. So that is why I said this portion of the Gita, I feel, is trying to reassure us. He's saying that we should have this confidence that we are so much in advantage. We have the Lord by our side, and there is no way we can slip and fail. Then comes the statement, which, as I said, we have heard Swami mention many, many times in his discourses. There is a contextual meaning to it, and also a standalone meaning, more like an instruction from Swami, and it is in that sense that Swami would often relate it in his discourses. What is that statement? He says, anityam, impermanent, asukham, unhappy, lokam is this world. This world, Krishna says, is anityam, asukham, is one that is impermanent and is not capable of giving happiness. Imam prapya, having obtained this, having come to this world, which has these qualities of anityam and asukham, bhajasvamam, worship me. So if we see it in the context of what Krishna has been saying in this past couple of shlokas, especially about being born in a certain community or a gender or so on and so forth, he's saying, remember that this world itself is anityam and asukam. Nothing in this world is permanent. So pain is also not eternal. All of these qualities and advantages and disadvantages that we speak of, they're all momentary. Who is a woman today might have been a man before. Who is a Brahmin today may be born in a backward tribe tomorrow. All obstacles and disadvantages we have are all temporary, because that is the nature of everything in this world. Name, form, and whatever is attached to that name and form are all temporary, because this world is anityam. At the same time, this world is also asukham. It does not have the capacity to give us true happiness. And this is because it is anityam. Just like how pain is not permanent in this world, even happiness that this world gives isn't. We've discussed this before. The promise of happiness with a caveat that it will be taken away is actually a promise of pain. Swami had once called a politician, an Indian politician, for an interview. I think he was a minister. Swami spoke to him for quite some time, and then at the end of the interview, Swami came out. Quite often it would happen that after an interview, Swami would come and tell the students and teachers seated there whom he spoke to and what happened inside the interview room. So Swami comes out and starts talking to the devotees and the senior staff and students there. And then Swami said, you know, I just gave an interview to this minister. He had some problems and he had prayed to Swami to solve them, and Swami had solved it, and so he has come to express his gratitude. So one of the senior teachers who was sitting there, he said, yes, Swami, we keep hearing it seems to be in a lot of problems. Then Swami, you know, frowned and asked, do you mean to say that people come to me only because they have problems? The way the teacher conveyed it, it appeared like, yes, Swami, of course, he has come to you. He has come for an interview. He must be having problems. Literally, that was the idea that seemingly got conveyed with the way the teacher responded to Swami. And Swami said, are you trying to say that only people who have problems come to me? And this teacher said, "Isn't it so, Swami? Whoever comes to you seems to be having problems." Then Swami told him, "Who doesn't have problems in this world?" And then Swami went on to say, "The nature of this world is such that it says, I will give you happiness, I will give you happiness, but it never gives you that true happiness because it doesn't have it." Swami said, "True happiness is only to be found within." Then Swami explained, "That is what I have come for, to direct this pursuit of happiness inwards." And that very same scene is playing out here. Arjuna is turning to the avatar and the avatar is turning him within, saying, "Imam prapya bhajasvamam," having come to this world which is anityam and asukham, worship me, because that is the only way you can find nitya sukham, eternal happiness. Now let me speak a little about Swami quoting the shloka in his discourses. Any number of times Swami has spoken about it. As I said, whenever Swami quotes it, invariably it is like an instruction. During the 1979 Samukos discourse, Swami, while speaking about the Bhagavad Gita, had said that Krishna's discourse to Arjuna was actually quite brief. The Bhagavad Gita that we all read today has been, Swami says, embellished and beautified by Vyasa's poetic genius. Of course, in the same discourse, Swami also states clearly that every verse of the Gita is equally potent. Swami says, Gita is like a matchbox with 700 matchsticks. Each matchstick is capable of lighting a lamp and dispelling the darkness. But when Swami was referring to this elaboration by Vyasa, this, you know, Vyasa taking the words of Krishna and making it more elaborate and explaining it further, Swami says that this one statement that Krishna makes, "Anityam asukham lokam imam prapya bhajasvamam," was elaborated by Vyasa in 7 verses. Of course, Swami doesn't say which are those 7 verses, but that gives an idea of this statement and how it carries an essential instruction. So without clearly saying it, Swami has said that this is one of the statements that Krishna probably really said, right? As I said, it really doesn't matter because Swami says all the verses are as important and as potent. But if at all you're looking for what are those verses that Krishna really said, then Swami states that this statement, "Anityam asukham lokam imam prapya bhajasvamam," was one of those statements which Vyasa took 7 verses to explain. So whenever Swami would quote this shloka, as I said, it was as an instruction. An instruction that has 2 parts to it. One involves an acknowledgement and the other an action. "Anityam asukham lokam" is the acknowledgement, and "imam prapya bhajasvamam" is the command to act. For the acknowledgement, the statement, that portion of the line which I said is an acknowledgement, Swami tells a very nice analogy or a chinakatha, which I myself have multiple times quoted. I don't know whether in this series, but in my other programs, I most certainly have spoken about this. Swami says, a man walks into a military hotel. Some of you may not know what a military hotel is. In South India, there are some restaurants that serve purely non-vegetarian meals, right, or non-vegetarian food. This would be exactly opposite to the typical Udupi hotel or the typical tiffin centers that you find spread all over the south. And these tiffin centers and hotels would offer vegetarian food. And a military hotel will have, the non-vegetarian dishes, and it generally will not have these typical vegetarian Indian foods of idlis, dosas and upmas and pungals and all that. So Swami was saying that this man walks into a military hotel, and when the waiter comes to him and tells him, And when the waiter comes and asks him what he wants, he says, get me a plate of idli sambar. And Swami would tell, in his typical sense of humor, he would say, in a military hotel, you don't get idli and dosa. You will only get kurma and barma, keema and kaima. That's how Swami puts it. And Swami says, so this man comes into the military hotel and orders for idli sambar. And the server tells him, you fool, didn't you look at the board outside? The man asks, why? What is there with the board? He says, we have put a big board outside the restaurant that says military hotel. Still, you come inside and you ask for idli sambar. What a fool you are. Swami would say, in the same way, this world also has a board outside it. And that board is Anityam Asukham Lokam. Like it says military hotel, here it says Anityam Asukham Lokam. In this world, you will find only temporary stuff and temporary happiness, which is nothing but asukham, sadness. Without reading that board, we come into this world and we are searching for nitya sukham. We are ordering, like that man asking for idli sambar. We are sitting on the table and we're sitting and asking, give me nitya sukham, eternal happiness. Swami says, how can you get it? The board itself says that that is not available here. So the first point is, understand and acknowledge the nature of this world and stop searching for permanence and happiness in it. How can you find something that is not there? Because otherwise, there's only going to be disappointment. If you're going to search for something which is not there in that place, then the journey is going to be nothing but a journey towards disappointment. And that's the case with most of us. And as Swami said, the world is illusive. As he had told that senior professor, Drishya Kalpitamaina Lokam, Swami had defined the world. This world is an illusion. It says that I will give it to you. And that's the problem, right? If it says that it is not there, if the world says that there is no happiness here, we wouldn't search for it. But it doesn't tell you the truth that there is no happiness here. It promises and makes you run after that happiness. So the first thing that needs to be done is acknowledge the nature of this world. And then comes the instruction. Imam prapya bhajaswamam. Having come here, now worship me. And what does this worship me mean? Well, that was what has been explained in the last part of this chapter. How to worship, with what to worship. We'll probably go to the last shloka of this chapter where Krishna emphasizes this command, bhajaswamam, right? Just like how I was saying, that when Krishna says that with devotion, even the worst person can become a sadhu and all of that, it is important to understand what it means to be devoted also, isn't it? So the entire chapter that we have gone through is an explanation of all of that. And in this last verse, Krishna is going to summarize all of that. And as I said, this shloka is also a very important one. And I will tell you why it is important. It is not in a straightforward way, but still, it is still straightforward enough. So we will listen to the last verse, the 34th verse of the 9th chapter. And this time I will definitely give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Manmana bhava madbhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru mame vaishyasi yuktvaivam atmanam matparayanah.
Having your mind fixed on me, be devoted to me, sacrifice to me, and bow down to me. By concentrating your mind and accepting me as the supreme goal, you shall surely attain me, who am thus the self. So that's the 34th verse, the final verse of this beautiful 9th chapter. And as I just mentioned, the shloka is very special in a very indirect way. In Swami's discourses, I think one of the early discourses sometime in the 50s when Swami had spoken about the Gita, he had said that if we have to pick only one shloka from the entire Bhagavad Gita and contemplate on it, let this be the shloka. And when I say let this be the shloka, Swami did not mention this shloka, the 34th of the 9th chapter. Swami had actually made a reference to shloka in the 18th chapter, the 65th verse of the 18th chapter, to be precise. Then why am I mentioning that in this place? I will mention it again when we come to the 65th verse of the 18th chapter. The reason I am mentioning it here is, this shloka is very, very identical to the shloka that Swami says is the one essential shloka of the entire Bhagavad Gita. In fact, the first line of the shloka and the first line of that shloka is exactly the same. There's no difference at all. The second line of both shlokas more or less convey the same meaning with a very, very slight difference. So in that sense, we would not be wrong in saying that this shloka too is equally potent and worthy of contemplation. And that is a beautiful and perfect summary of whatever Krishna has conveyed in this entire chapter. Krishna says, Manmanaha bhava. Manmanaha means with mind filled with me. Manmanaha bhava means may you be in that state where the mind is filled with me. This bhava can be used for the next two words also to convey the state that Krishna is telling about. So first he says, Manmanaha bhava. May you be in that state where the mind is filled with me. Madbhaktaha bhava. Be devoted to me. Madhyaji bhava. Be one who worships or sacrifices only for me. Mam namaskuru. Meaning, bow down to me. There's another beautiful and important way of looking at this statement. Namaha kuru. Mam namaskuru. Mam namaha kuru. Nama means salutation or prostration. It also means to surrender. And kuru means do. It's a command to act. So mam namaskuru means do the act of surrendering to me. Surrendering is something that has to be actively done. It is not a passive state. And all these instructions that he gives in this line, as I mentioned, have to be established in this chapter. Whatever Krishna has been telling in this chapter about what is worship, when he says Manmanaha bhava, what is it to be always thinking of Krishna? What way you should be thinking of him? Similarly, when he says Madbhaktaha, be devoted to me, be focused to me, what does it mean to be focused on Krishna? Madhyaji bhava, what does it mean to worship him? What does it mean to sacrifice to him? Simply, if you look at the shloka, it appears like God is telling, oh, you must worship me, you should make sacrifices to me, bow to me. And to add to all of that, he also said, it even doesn't matter to me if you're a sinner, if you do all of this, you're taken care of. So that could be really misleading, isn't it? We get a wrong picture of God and what is spirituality. But Krishna is explaining what it is to be focused on God, that state of manmanaha. Similarly, what is it to be devoted to him and him alone and not worshipping other deities? What does it mean? What is the idea behind dismissing other deities? Similarly, what is it to surrender? It is not giving up anything or everything, but it is doing what has to be done with a sense of surrender. That is why it is Mam Namaskuru. Do surrender. Literally, that's what it means. And what happens when you're able to do all this? Yuktva evam atmanam. Having prepared yourself this way, mat parayanaha, taking me as the supreme goal. I should define your journey, right? Matparayanaha. The destination always defines the nature of the journey. So when you make God the supreme goal, your journey is accordingly defined. Matparayanaha. Be one for whom I am the supreme goal of this journey. When you do all this, Mam eva eshyasi, you reach me certainly. Another way of looking at this line, the last line of this chapter, is yuktva evam. First I said yuktva evam atmanam, having prepared yourself this way. That is one way of splitting the line. The other way is yuktva evam, having attained yukti, atmanam mameva eshyasi, you reach me, which is your own self, or you reach this knowledge that I am your true self. So from the point of view of spirituality, I think both of these are equally correct, right? You reach that state to discover yourself. You reach that state to discover God. You reach that state to discover that yourself and the divinity that you've been loving and seeking is one and the same. A very profound shloka to end this chapter, where Krishna says, through devotion, you can attain the ultimate, and there needs to be no doubt whatsoever about it. And that devotion can be seen from different points of view. From the point of view of a devotee, and that itself varies based on the nature of the devotee, right? Artha, arthathi, jignasu. Whatever is the nature of the devotee, the devotion also takes a different flavor. And that is what Krishna mentioned in the earlier chapters. When you have desires or fears, you become worshippers of deities and end up looking at devotion as something that has to be expressed through rituals, because that becomes, as we've been talking, it becomes a karma. It becomes specific to a certain god or a deity or a devata. But this entire portion of the Gita is looking at devotion from Krishna's point of view, from Swami's point of view. And when seen that way, we see that devotion is so beautiful, like a simple wild flower. No ostentation, no fanfare, just tenderness and simple beauty. He says, just love me. Just be my beloved. Be love struck. I don't want anything else. And this love that you fostered in your heart will make simple, normal actions that you do into sadhana. Whatever you eat, it will convert it into prasadam. Simple help that you render, simple charities that you do, will become grand offerings. That is the essence of this entire portion, where Krishna redefines devotion and then says that this devotion, if it is attained, or at least if you strive for this devotion, there is nothing else that needs to be done. Right? There is nothing else that needs to be achieved, because Mam eva eshyasi, you will, with this kind of devotion, you will reach me. You will certainly reach me. Yuktva evam atmanam. Whatever is the preparation that your individual self needs to undergo, this pursuit itself will give you that. And then you will be brought to me. And when you are brought to me, you realize your true self as being one with me. So that is why this chapter is very important, because it introduces or establishes the importance of bhakti, which, as I said, is going to be spoken about in detail in a later chapter, the 12th chapter. But that establishing of what is the importance of bhakti, and as we've seen, no wonder so many verses from this chapter, so many phrases from this chapter have been so often quoted by Swami. The last one being anityam asukam loke imam prapya bhajas vamam. Before I started the program today, in the first segment, I was talking about this. We are all in this world. We are today in this whirlpool where You know, wherever you turn, there is uncertainty. For once, we are really looking at the world. It looks like what the world does to us has been compressed and is being played out to us. Today, we are speaking to someone. We are not too sure whether we will meet that person, right? There are so many people whom we met a few weeks back and suddenly we hear that they are no more with us. So this is the nature of the world itself, right? This is not something new. The uncertainty that we are facing today is what has been built into this creation, because it is anityam asukham lokam. But we are literally being woken up into this reality. And when we see it, what can we do? As Swami said, this search for happiness has to turn within. And how do you turn within? Imam prapya bhajasva mam. Having come to this world, worship me and turn within. So that is the last verse and the entire chapter of the ninth chapter. As I was telling, we will do a summary of that when we meet next time. I thought of starting the summary this week itself, but then I think it's good to have it as a separate episode where we can cover it and give it its due importance. Talking about whatever Krishna has been telling in this particular chapter, as I was just telling you, devotion can be looked at in different ways. An atheist might look at devotion and the acts of worship and you know, have his own views about it. A devotee who's a simple devotee who has simple needs in life and who prays to God for it may have different views. You know, we have all kinds of beliefs and belief systems in India. If you go to the cornermost and rural areas, you'll find all kinds of beliefs, all kinds of deities being worshipped. It's all out of the need of the hour, right? Every disease becomes, even a disease becomes a deity. And then you worship it for its grace. These are all needs of that individual, and that takes the form of devotion. So this devotion can be seen in many ways, and what we are trying to do through this is to look at devotion from the point of view of the Lord, because we have to offer to Him what He wants, right? We have to offer it to Him in the way He seeks it from us. The opportunity of seeing, knowing, reading about, listening about, and living with an avatar is that we get to see what is it that He wants from us, and can we modify our lives and can we turn our lives in that manner. I came across this very beautiful poem that I thought I will read. It's a pretty long one, so I'm going to read out that whole thing. It's a very famous poem too. The name of the poem is Moses and the Shepherd. And this is a poem that has been written, I'm not too sure in which language, but by the great Sufi saint Rumi. Most of you must be familiar with that name. The version that I'm going to read out is a translation by Coleman Barks, one of the very famous translators of the poems of Rumi. Most of the English poems that you see as being attributed to Rumi have been translated by Coleman Barks. So this I'm going to read out is about Moses and a shepherd, as the name itself suggests. I will read out the whole verse and then probably I'll revisit some of the lines which are so very beautiful. It's in very simple English and I'm sure most of you will follow the idea that is being conveyed. This is how the poem goes. Moses heard a shepherd on the road praying, God, where are you? I want to help you, to fix your shoes and comb your hair. I want to wash your clothes and pick the lice off. I want to bring you milk, to kiss your little hands and feet when it's time for you to go to bed. I want to sweep your room and keep it neat, God. My sheep and goats are yours. All I can say remembering you is eh and ah. Moses could stand it no longer. Who are you talking to? The one who made us and made the earth and made the sky. Don't talk about shoes and socks with God. And what's this with your little hands and feet? Such blasphemous familiarity sounds like you're chatting with your uncles. Only something that grows needs milk. Only someone with feet needs shoes. Not God. Even if you meant God's human representatives, as when God said, "I was sick and you did not visit me," even then, this tone would be foolish and irreverent. Use appropriate terms. Fatima is a fine name for a woman, but if you call a man Fatima, it's an insult. Body and birth language are right for us on this side of the river, but not for addressing the origin, not for Allah. The shepherd repented and tore his clothes and sighed and wandered out into the desert. A sudden revelation then came to Moses, God's voice. You have separated me from one of my own. Did you come as a prophet to unite or to sever? I have given each being a separate and unique way of seeing and knowing that knowledge. What seems wrong to you is right for him. What is poison to one is honey to someone else. Purity and impurity, sloth and diligence in worship, these mean nothing to me. I am apart from all that. Ways of worshipping are not to be ranked as better or worse than one another. Hindus do Hindu things. The Dravidian Muslims in India do what they do. It's all praise and it's all right. It's not me that's glorified in acts of worship. It's the worshippers. I don't hear the words they say. I look inside at the humility. That broken, open lowliness is the reality, not the language. Forget phraseology. I want burning. Burning. Be friends with your burning. Burn up your thinking and your forms of expression. Moses, those who pay attention to ways of behaving and speaking are one sort. Lovers who burn are another. Don't impose a property tax on a burned out village. Don't scold the lover. The wrong way he talks is better than 100 right ways of others. Inside the Kaaba, it doesn't matter which direction you point to your prayer rug. The ocean diver doesn't need snowshoes. The love religion has no code or doctrine, only God. So the ruby has nothing engraved on it. It doesn't need markings. God began speaking deeper mysteries to Moses, vision and words which cannot be recorded here, poured into and through him. He left himself and came back. He went to eternity and came back here. Many times this happened. It's foolish of me to try and say this. If I did say it, it would uproot our human intelligences. It would shatter all writing pens. Moses ran after the shepherd. He followed the bewildered footprints, in one place moving straight like a castle, across a chessboard, in another sideways like the bishop. Now surging like a wave cresting, now sliding down like a fish, with always his feet making geomancy symbols in the sand, recording his wandering state. Moses finally caught up with him. I was wrong. God has revealed to me that there are no rules for worship. Say whatever and however your loving tells you to. Your sweet blasphemy is truest devotion. Through you, a whole world is freed. Loosen your tongue and don't worry what comes out. It's all the light of the Spirit. The shepherd replied, "Moses, Moses, I have gone beyond even that. You applied the whip and my horses shied and jumped out of itself. The divine nature and my human nature came together. Bless your scolding hand and your arm. I can't say what happened. What I am saying now is not my real condition. It can't be said." The shepherd grew quiet. "When you look in a mirror, you see yourself, not the state of the mirror. The flute player puts breath into a flute, and who makes the music? Not the flute, the flute player. Whenever you speak praise or thanksgiving to God, it's always like this dear shepherd's simplicity. When you eventually see through the veils to how things really are, you will keep saying again and again, 'This is certainly not like we thought it was.'" So that is that beautiful poem by Rumi, and in so many ways, you know, even as you're going through this poem, it brings back so many portions of this ninth chapter that we came across. In case some of you didn't follow, this is the story of what is being conveyed here. Moses, in his wanderings, comes across this shepherd who seems to be telling all kinds of blasphemous things in the name of prayer. He's saying, "Oh God, I want to comb your hair, I want to wash your clothes, I want to bring you milk." And he says, "Whatever sheep and goat I have, it is all yours." And he says, "You know, remembering you, I'm only saying I and ah," which means I don't even know how to pray. I don't even know any incantations. A very intimate and familiar relationship the shepherd has with Moses. But Moses looks at it and says, "What kind of prayer is this? How can you talk of God like this? As though God has feet and he needs shoes, as though God has hair and it needs oiling, and, you know, all kinds of things." He says, "All these things are blasphemous." So the shepherd feels very bad and, you know, tears his clothes and goes away. And then God speaks to Moses and reveals to him what a mistake he had done. And whatever has been so beautifully captured in this poem is what Krishna has been saying in this chapter. He says, "Each one has their own way of approaching me. There is nothing like right and wrong from where I am. What seems right to you might be wrong to someone else. But for me, what I see is that humility which is within." And a very beautiful statement, he says, "It's not me that's glorified in acts of worship." When Krishna says, "Bhajaswamam," when he says, "Be devoted to me, worship me, you know, always think of me and nothing else," he's not looking for glory through our worship. It is not me that's glorified in acts of worship. It's the worshippers. Through such ananya bhakti, we benefit. We raise ourselves. It means nothing to him. I don't hear words they say. I look inside at the humility. He says, "I am always looking for that feeling that is driving this prayer." And then these beautiful and very profound words. He says, "I want burning. Burning. Be friends with your burning." It's a reference to the craving for God that you should have. God says, "I want that craving. I want burning. Be friends with your burning. Burn up your thinking and your forms of expression." Then he says, "Those who pay attention to ways of behaving and speaking are one sort," which we were saying that, you know, rituals have to be performed in such and such a way, worship has to be done such and such a way. He's saying that those who pay attention to ways of behaving are one sort. Lovers who burn are another. Those who have this kind of craving and love for God, don't judge them on the basis of what is right and what is wrong. Don't impose a property tax on a burned out village. What lovely words. Don't impose property tax on a burned out village. Don't scold the lover. the wrong way he talks is better than 100 right ways of others. The wrong way he talks is better than 100 right ways of others. Right? What beautiful words he's saying. It is not what you give to me. Patram pushpam phalam toyam. It doesn't matter what you give to me. What I am seeking is that burning. Right? He says, I want burning. Be friends with your burning. And that burning raises to dust everything else. Right? And then he, this beautiful analogy of saying, inside the Kaaba, it doesn't matter which direction you point your rug. You know, there is this practice when they do the namaz, they always face in the direction of the Kaaba. Right? So if you're in this side of the world, like where we are, the Muslims, when they do their worship, they turn westwards when they're doing it. If you're in that side of the Kaaba, you turn eastwards when you're doing your worship, right? But if you are in the Kaaba, right? If you've seen visuals of Kaaba, you have the central shrine and people are all around it. So he says, when you are in the Kaaba, it doesn't matter which direction you point your rug. When you are in the presence of the Lord, when your heart is one with the Lord, it doesn't matter what you do, what is right, what is wrong. The ocean diver doesn't need snowshoes. Only the one who is walking on the shores probably needs shoes. The one who has decided to take a dive doesn't need. The love religion has no code or doctrine. It only knows God. Right? And finally, those towards the end, the words which are said, when you look in a mirror, you see yourself, not the state of the mirror. The end of this journey, when you come face to face with the Lord, when you look at Him, as we have discussed this before, He's a perfect mirror. And looking at it, you're going to look at yourself. You're not going to look at the state of the mirror, but you're going to see yourself. The flute player puts breath into a flute. And who makes the music? It is not the flute, the flute player. The whole idea of becoming an instrument in the hands of the Lord. Some you would often say that is the beautiful symbolism of the flute, where the flute is just allowing the breath of the Lord to create music out of it. The flute player puts breath into a flute, and who makes the music? Not the flute, the flute player. With that, probably we'll come to the end of this chapter. As I said, we'll meet next week with a summary of the ninth chapter. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to take this journey with all of you, for the opportunity to read out that beautiful poem. For those of you who are looking for it, the poem's name is Moses and the Shepherd, translated by Coleman Barks. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I thank each one of you for your company. I seek your company for the rest of the journey too. We have exactly completed one half of the Bhagavad Gita chapter-wise, 9 chapters of the 18. Hopefully, Swami will remain with us as he's remained with us through these first 9 chapters for the rest of the series too. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. I'll meet you again at 12 for today's afternoon satsang. Till I meet you all next week on the Gita series, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.